Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. On today's program, you will hear stories from Brian Lynn and John Russell. We close our program with another episode of The Making of a Nation. But first, a new Taiwan law bars news media from reporting different kinds of information about suicides, including methods used. Limits on media reporting are aimed at reducing the number of people who try to kill themselves. Taiwan officials say about 7,000 young people between the ages of 13 and 19 attempted suicide in 2018. That number is 19% above the world average, notes the island's Ministry of Health and Welfare. Under the new Suicide Prevention Act, newspapers, websites, and television stations can be fined up to about $33,000 for showing pictures or videos of suicides. They also can be fined for reporting details of suicide methods or explaining how to buy tools for suicide. Even explaining why an individual might have committed suicide can lead to punishment. The Act cleared its public consultation period last week. Taiwan's government can now make changes as it wishes, or enforce the law in its current form. Wu Chia-yi is with the National Taiwan University's College of Medicine. Wu said that suicides normally go up in Taiwan for 3 months following reports that identify famous people who killed themselves, as well as how and where they died. According to our clinical experience and some of our interaction with patients, we've discovered that the more detailed info, the more influential it is, Wu said. Taiwan's four major daily newspapers and many websites currently report on famous people who take their own lives, as well as other unusual suicides. The stories may go into great detail. Cedric Alviani heads the East Asia office of the group Reporters Without Borders. He said he understands what Taiwan officials are trying to do, but he thinks the law will limit the media's ability to get the story right. He said, "We perfectly understand that it is their duty to try and bring improvements to the society and address that terrible society problem that is suicide, and especially suicide of teenagers. However, the solution they propose is not a solution. New Zealand is the only place that has a similar law," Alviani added. "In that country, the media cannot report a suicide's method without the medical examiner's permission. In other places, media companies follow World Health Organization guidance. WHO officials suggest avoiding explicit description of methods, details of where people died, and undue repetitions of suicide stories. Restrictions on suicide reporting could open the door for other kinds of media restrictions," notes Joanna Lei, head of the Chunghua 21st Century Research Group in Taiwan. "I see this as a social responsibility of the media," Lay said. It should not be legislated. Reporters Without Borders said Taiwan's government should better organize the media and talk to news operations about ethics. Taiwan's major media currently take down social media posts if experts ask them to, Wu said. Most newspapers in Taiwan limit their coverage of suicides, but still put major cases on their front pages, said Fang Chun-kai, director of the Suicide Prevention Center at Mackay Memorial Hospital in Taipei. He suggests putting reports about suicide with other society news and away from the day's top stories.
On Scotland's Isle of Skye, scientists have identified two areas with evidence of ancient life forms. Researchers believe the markings are, in fact, footprints from dinosaurs that lived 170 million years ago. They say the prints date to the middle of the Jurassic period, a time from which few dinosaur fossils have been recovered. Researchers reported this month on their study of about 50 fossilized footprints at the two sites. The markings are just a few hundred meters apart from each other. They are said to show dinosaurs walking in different directions. At least three kinds of dinosaurs left the footprints. Steve Brusett, the leader of the research team, is a paleontologist with the University of Edinburgh. The tracks are located on flat rocky surfaces near the beach, so they are only exposed at low tide, he said. The tide laps across them, back and forth, every day. One set of markings came from a two-legged, meat-eating dinosaur that researchers say was about the size of a car. They say its footprints have three toes. The creature, with sharp claws, appears to be from a group of dinosaurs called theropods. Bigger, three-toed footprints came from large-bodied, two-legged plant eaters called ornithopods, or perhaps, the researchers say, a large theropod. All of these prints had worn-down toes, not sharp edges. The researchers are especially interested in markings left by another creature, an early member of a group of heavily built, four-legged plant eaters called stegosaurs. The footprints represent some of the oldest evidence anywhere of a stegosaur, notes Paige DiPolo, a doctoral student at the University of Edinburgh. DiPolo was the lead writer of a report on the study. The findings were published in the journal Plus One. The most famous member of the stegosaurs was Stegosaurus, which lived late in the Jurassic period. It had large, bony protective plates around the neck and back, and a large spiked tail, too. Brusett was careful to note that the researchers still have a lot of unanswered questions about this creature. I suspect this stegosaur was about the size of a cow, which is fairly small for a stegosaur. Whether that's because it's a primitive, smaller species, or a juvenile of a bigger species, we're not sure, he said. The researchers noted that the findings were an important window into the many kinds of dinosaurs on the Isle of Skye. Sky has emerged as one of the most important windows into Jurassic dinosaur evolution. We know that dinosaurs were diversifying with a frenzy in the Middle Jurassic, but there are few fossil sites of this age anywhere in the world, Roussette added. I'm John Russell.
A small Italian company has used 3D printing technology to quickly produce oxygen valves to treat some coronavirus patients. Italy has been battling the world's largest number of cases of the new coronavirus outside of China. Christian Fracassi founded and heads the Italian startup company Isonova. He told the Reuters news agency that he heard about a shortage of the valves at a hospital near the northern city of Brescia. The area has had an explosion of coronavirus cases. The devices are called Venturi valves. They are named after 18th century Italian physicist Giovanni Battista. The devices are used to connect patient masks to oxygen equipment. The oxygen masks are used to treat patients suffering from breathing problems. Fracassi, a 36-year-old engineer, said the hospital was in serious need of the valves. The devices are impossible to find at the moment, he said. He added that the fast-spreading virus was simply preventing current production from meeting the growing demand. He decided to offer the services of his company's 3D printing equipment and of his 14 employees to help ease the shortage. When we heard about the shortage, we got in touch with the hospital immediately. We printed some prototypes. The hospital tested them and told us they worked, Fracassi said. So we printed 100 valves and I delivered them personally. The company's team was able to effectively copy the valves using a 3D printer at the company headquarters in Milan. The company produces a series of technology products. They include high-tech luggage for Italian designer Gucci and a special paint developed to survive temperatures up to 1,000 degrees Celsius. Fracassi told Reuters it cost his company very little to produce the plastic valves, which weigh around 20 grams each. I'm not going to charge the hospital, he said. It was the least I could do to help doctors and nurses who work all day long to save human lives. The company's quick action to help coronavirus patients was praised by Italy's Minister of Innovation Technology Digitalization, Paola Pisano. In a Twitter message, she thanked Fracassi and his employees for supplying the valves. She also published a picture of the freshly made 3D devices. At least 10 hospital patients had used the new valves as of March 14th, reported Massimo Temporelli, the president and co-founder of Italy's Fab Lab. The organization creates technology-based solutions for companies. It has worked with Isonova in the past. In a Facebook post, Fracassi said he did not want to be called a hero or a genius for the actions he took. Sure, people were going to die, but we only did our duty, he wrote. Fracassi added that refusing to act after learning of the need could have likely resulted in more patient deaths. In the message, Fracassi said the company does not plan to profit from its valve production and will only use its designs and manufacturing methods to help those currently in need. He added, "Let's focus on the real heroes, those who save lives, who work 16-hour hospital shifts and are day and night next to the sick, and praise them." I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. History is full of examples of leaders joining together to meet common goals. But rarely have two leaders worked together with as much friendship and cooperation as Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill did. Roosevelt was President of the United States. Churchill was Prime Minister of Britain. The two men had much in common. They were both born to wealthy families, and they were both active in politics for many years. Both leaders also shared a love of history and nature and the sea. Roosevelt and Churchill first met when they were lower-level officials during World War I, but neither man remembered much about that meeting. However, as they worked together during the Second World War, they came to like and trust each other. Roosevelt and Churchill exchanged more than 1,700 letters and messages over a period of 5.5 years. They met many times at large international gatherings and in private talks. But the closeness of their friendship might be seen best in a story told by one of Roosevelt's close advisors, Harry Hopkins. Hopkins remembered how Churchill was visiting Roosevelt at the White House one day. Roosevelt went into Churchill's room in the morning to say hello, but the president was shocked to see Churchill coming from the bathroom with no clothes on. Roosevelt immediately apologized to the British leader, but Churchill reportedly answered, "The Prime Minister of Great Britain has nothing to hide from the President of the United States." The United States and Great Britain were the most powerful of the nations that joined together as allies to resist Germany's Adolf Hitler and his Axis partners. In January of 1942, 26 of the Allied nations signed an agreement promising to fight for the goals of peace, religious freedom, human rights, and justice. The three major allies were the United States, Britain, and the Soviet Union. The governments in Washington and London did not always agree. For example, they disagreed about when to attack Hitler's forces in Western Europe. And Churchill resisted Roosevelt's suggestions that Britain give up some of its colonies. But in general, the friendship between Roosevelt and Churchill, and between the United States and Britain, led the two nations to cooperate closely. This was not true with the Soviets. The Soviet Union was a communist country. It did not share the same history or political system as the United States or Britain. And the Soviet Union had its own interests to protect along its borders and in other areas. Relations between the Soviet Union and the Western Allies were mixed. On the one hand, Hitler's invasion deep into the Soviet Union had forced Joseph Stalin and other Soviet leaders to make victory over the Germans their most important goal. On the other hand, shadows of future problems could already be seen. The Soviet Union was making clear its desire to keep political control over Poland, and it was supporting communist fighters in Yugoslavia and Greece. These differences were not discussed much, as the foreign ministers of Britain, the Soviet Union, and the United States gathered in Moscow in 1943. Instead, they reached several agreements, including on a plan to establish a new organization called the United Nations. Finally, Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin met together for the first time. They met in Tehran in late 1943, mainly to discuss the military situation. However, the three leaders also considered political questions, such as the future of Germany, Eastern Europe, and East Asia. Later, the Allies made further plans for the new United Nations. They arranged for new international economic organizations, the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And the Allies agreed to divide Germany into different parts after the war for a temporary period. The Soviet Union would occupy the eastern part, while Britain, France, and the United States would occupy the west. Washington, London, and Moscow were united during the early years of the war because of military need. They knew they must fight together to defeat their common enemy. But this unity faded as Allied troops marched toward the German border. Roosevelt continued to call on the world to wait until the last bullet was fired before deciding what would come next. But Churchill, Stalin, and other leaders already were trying to shape the world that would follow the war. Now differences between the Allies became more serious. The most important question was Poland. Hitler's invasion of Poland in 1939 had started the war. Roosevelt and Churchill believed strongly that the Polish people should have the right to choose their own leaders after the war. Churchill supported a group of Polish resistance leaders who had an office in London. In 1940, Polish flyers had taken part in the Battle of Britain, piloting British warplanes against the German Luftwaffe. But Stalin had other ideas. He demanded that Poland's border be changed to give more land to the Soviet Union, and he refused to help the Polish resistance leaders in London. Instead, he supported a group of Polish communists and helped them establish a new government in Poland. Churchill visited Stalin late in 1944. The two leaders met with Roosevelt a few months later in Yalta on the Crimean coast. All agreed that free elections should be held quickly in Poland, and they traded ideas about the future of Eastern Europe, China, and other areas of the world. Roosevelt was in good spirits when he reported to Congress after his return from the Yalta conference.
I come from the Crimea conference with a firm belief that we have made a good start on the road to a world of peace. There were two main purposes in this Crimea conference. The first was to bring defeat to Germany. The the greatest possible speed and the smallest possible loss of Allied men. That purpose is now being carried out in great force. The German army and the German people are feeling the ever-increasing might of our fighting men and of the Allied armies, and every hour gives us added pride in the heroic advance of our troops in Germany, on German soil, toward a meeting with the gallant Red Army. The second purpose was to continue to build the foundation for an international accord that would bring order and security after the chaos of the war. It would give some assurance of lasting peace among nations of the world. That goal, too, in that goal, toward that goal, a tremendous stride was made.
Roosevelt went on to say that the peace cannot be a completely perfect system at first, but it can be a peace based on the idea of freedom. Churchill had the same high hopes. He told the British Parliament after the conference that Stalin and other Soviet leaders wished to live in honorable friendship. "I also know that their word is honest," Churchill said. But as history proved, Roosevelt and Churchill were wrong about the Soviets. In the months after the Yalta Conference, relations between Moscow and the Western democracies grew steadily worse. The Soviet Union moved to seize control of Eastern Europe. Stalin began making strong speeches, charging that Washington and London were holding secret peace negotiations with Germany. And the Soviet Union refused to discuss ways to bring democracy to Poland. Churchill wrote later that he had always held the Russian people in high honor, but their shadow darkened the picture after the war. Britain and America had gone to war not just to defend the smaller countries, but also to fight for individual rights and freedoms. Churchill went on to say that the Soviet Union had other goals. Its hold tightened on Eastern Europe after the Soviet army gained control. And Churchill said that after the long suffering and efforts of World War II, it seemed that half of Europe had just exchanged one dictator for another. Churchill and Roosevelt agreed in secret letters that they must try to oppose the Soviet effort. But before they could act, Roosevelt died. And the world began to live through a new war, the Cold War, in the years to follow. Roosevelt's death, from bleeding in the brain, also ended a deep personal friendship between two world leaders. Winston Churchill later wrote about hearing the news of the death of his close friend. "I felt as if I had been struck with a physical blow," Churchill wrote. He said he was overpowered by a sense of deep and permanent loss. The free world joined Churchill in mourning the loss of so strong a leader as Franklin Roosevelt. But it could not weep for long. War was giving way to peace. A new world was forming. And as we will hear in future programs, it was a world that few people expected.
That's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.